Something wicked is coming this way, and only fools are ignoring the signs. So it's time you became a financial prepper like thousands of others. Gold can travel anywhere. It's international. It's its own currency. Allocate to gold now, the timeless safe haven asset. Open an IRA with Noble Gold Investments to physically hold coins and bars, and let real, tangible gold, not just paper, save your portfolio as the economy burns again. Right now, Noble Gold Investments offers a free 3-ounce silver American Virtue coin with every qualified IRA. Just use the promo code GOLD to claim your free coin and secure your family's financial future. Go to NobleGoldInvestments.com now. NobleGoldInvestments.com.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
You guys, please sit back, relax, and grab your popcorn, because we're going to be right back after this very brief word from our sponsor with our special guest. All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for being here. Melindy over on Rumble says, please do a show or a topic about Ammon Bundy running for governor in Idaho. The family are true American legends. Well, it should be, I guess, your lucky day, because I did do a show with Ammon Bundy, and he definitely talked about his race for the governor of Idaho. Definitely check it out. Just go through the list of my shows over on Rumble. And thank you once again to everybody who's on screen with me right now. I have a couple of different people who have never actually been on the show before, but these are both two incredible patriots, esteemed colleagues of mine that I have wanted to do some work with here for a very long time. First of all, Craig from Just Informed Talk. Craig, how are you, buddy? I was just told that the Zoom audio was muted for the people at home. Can you guys verify for me that you can hear the guests now? Can you, somebody say something, say anything, and let's see if it's working.
Blah, 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 blah.
Hey, you're muted, by the way. I gather you figured that.
I don't think okay. I'm muted, but hey.
I'm not muted, am I? I can hear myself. Can you hear okay. me?
No. No, you guys were all muted. It was a setting through the thing, I think, Zach.
Yeah, gotcha. I think that, okay. So I think it should be working by now, but, you know, there's always that like 30 second delay. Now they can hear you. Okay, cool.
Great.
Well, let me just say that everyone is happy to be here. I'm happy to have you. And I'm glad that we were able to work through that slight technical difficulty. Chris, I'd like to start with you because I know that you don't have a lot of time tonight. And obviously, as lead counsel, there's only so much you can say. But I'm just wondering if you can maybe just give us kind of an overview of the case up until this point. We just had a hearing that was held in, I believe, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals this past week. I covered it here on the program, but, you know, it'd be great to hear it from the horse's mouth. What can you say?
Sure. So the case started as a result of the massive deplatforming of October 2020, which was in the days leading up to the election. And there was, of course, a lot of deplatforming and shadow banning and the like going on in 2020. And we started to see that and put together a case to challenge the censorship that was happening in this case on Google and YouTube. What was so interesting about our particular case is that Congress actually passed a resolution, H.R. 1154, on October 2nd, basically telling social media, the FBI and the like, that they didn't like certain speech. They called out conspiracy theories, they called out QAnon, And we all know they talked about raising authoritative information. And we all now know that all of that is code for speech we don't like and we don't want people to hear. And so almost immediately after Congress passed that resolution, many conservative social media bloggers and commentators and journalists were deplatformed all at once on October 15th. 17 of those are plaintiffs in this case. Collectively, they accounted for almost 800 million views and over 15,000 videos, more data, more media than the mainstream media channels. But they were all taken down, and they weren't even given a notice by YouTube. YouTube violated its own breach of its own terms of service and didn't even give them notice or give them an opportunity to retrieve their own content. So we've been fighting that case on a First Amendment grounds. And, you know, the challenge that we have is that it's always been considered that YouTube is a private, you know, entity. So just like they can refuse the right to serve anyone, essentially, and they get protections by Section 230. But in this case, what we told the court and we told the Ninth Circuit on Monday is that this is a case where the government is putting its thumb on the First Amendment scale by passing H.R. 1154, by various people, Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, and the like, making direct threats to social media that if they did not censor, they would lose their 230 immunity, that constituted the kind of threat and the kind of impact on the First Amendment that government's not supposed to have. So that was what the argument was about on Monday. The judges had asked some tough questions, and I have no idea which way they're going to go on this. But my understanding is that, you know, we'll get a decision in a few weeks or a few months. And whichever way it goes, I think this case has the potential of going even further. Google will surely appeal it if they lose to an en banc hearing. So will we. This is a case that's been designed to get to the Ninth Circuit, to get to the Supreme Court. So either we'll go up or we'll win and we'll go down and have a wonderful chance at doing discovery and find out what really happened here.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. You know, I just want to say, Chris, I thought you did a wonderful job this past week. You know, you really appeared to have a handle on the situation and, you know, the background, everything that had happened. You know, to somebody like myself, and I'm sure the others on the screen that have experienced this directly, I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but the judges, you know, I mean, it's their job to challenge you and to get you to really flesh out your argument. Can you comment at all on, you know, how you felt leaving the hearing? I mean, did you seem to think that it was fair?
Yeah, I thought it was a fair hearing. I thought the judges asked, you know, the right questions. The only thing that I think that the judges asked that I think was sort of unfair, but I think this is, again, them pushing the envelope, is they came up with this reasoning sort of on behalf of YouTube. Well, maybe you got deplatformed because of the election. Maybe YouTube was just, you know, exercising its own editorial discretion, which is what YouTube argued. And they weren't really being manipulated by the government. But the point is for us to go forward in our case, the judges don't have to believe it. You just have to think that it's a plausible theory. And I think it's extremely plausible, given the sequence of events, that it was the government that weighed in on the editorial discretion on the censorship issue in this case. And of course, we've seen recently, we saw Zuckerberg come out and talk about how the, you know, FBI told him to take down Hunter's laptop. So we know the government was exercising pressure. So I don't know if those questions represent a bit of a lack of knowledge or naivete on the part of those particular judges, or they were just pushing to see what the answers were. But you never know when you go to the Ninth Circuit like that. You know, and I think we'll probably see an en banc hearing after this, which is a hearing following a three-panel decision of a decision of a fuller set of judges. I think it's 11 or 13. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be the next step. And I'm excited to see what kind of reasoning they can come up with, possibly, because they're going to have to stretch the law pretty hard for us not to prevail in the Ninth Circuit. So very interested in seeing that.
All right. All right. Well,
Chris,
listen,
this is Sarah.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Can I ask a question real quick? Chris, can you address why it's important that we sue Google versus the federal government? Because a lot of people ask that question. And I think it's really important that people understand why suing Google is so important.
Well, there's a few things. First of all, when you sue the federal government, you sue any agency of the government or any official of the government, you get mired in a tremendous amount of immunities. And also, judges are less likely to grant you certain discovery rights. The government will come in and just say, oh, it's a national security issue. And the judges will accept that at face value and not go any further. When we're going up against someone like YouTube, we have a little more leverage in asking the hard questions and going after them. Also, the entity that took the plaintiffs down, took the journalists down, was YouTube. So there's a direct connection with YouTube. They also had contract terms with YouTube. YouTube violated their own contract terms when they took down the content. So we have a variety of claims against YouTube. The First Amendment was the most direct hit against YouTube. Also, the case, even though this isn't going to happen in the Ninth Circuit, a lot of the cases that have failed before have alleged that YouTube, because and social media in general, because we use the internet so much now, that they've essentially become the public square, the modern digital town square, the place where people go to debate. Now, the courts haven't grabbed onto that and agreed that they're subject to First Amendment concerns because they're performing a traditional public purpose. But I think that we may get there someday, either at the Supreme Court, which has signaled its interest in this particular issue. The Ninth Circuit has said, nope, YouTube, Google, social media, you know, not subject to the First Amendment, private entities. But there are some justices out there we can see in the Supreme Court in reading their opinions that they may well lean the other way. And with the composition of the Supreme Court now, I think we at least have a chance of the Supreme Court saying that all these cases, all these years, saying that YouTube is not subject to censorship laws because they're private, that may be pried open. So we need to keep that in the case. It's an important point. It's preserved for the Ninth Circuit. It's preserved for Supreme Court purposes. And there may be some action on that point. So to answer your question shortly, Sarah, very tough to litigate against the federal government. They put up all kinds of barriers. And the plaintiffs have a lot of other claims also against YouTube. And YouTube is really the responsible party here. If they're kowtowing to the government, then they ought to answer for it.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Me too. HR 1145 happened right before Google went ahead and started banning all the accounts that were talking about the Hunter Biden laptop. And I was wondering what, if I could ask you about the timing of that and why it's suspect.
Sure. On October 2nd, so the bill was introduced, the House resolution was introduced on September 25th, 2020. The House passed it on October 2nd, 2020. On October 2nd, 2020, that is the exact same day that Congress, a committee of Congress, issued a subpoena to the then CEO of Google to come testify before Congress. Understand that the power of subpoena from Congress is a weighty one. And the issue that he was called to testify on was exactly this, responsibility of the social media engine with respect to, you know, authoritative information, vaccines, elections, and so forth. So at the same time, they're calling Google to the carpet in Washington. They're considering this HR, and they passed HR 1154 on October 2nd. 15 days later, these creators all get wiped off the internet. So the timing, it looks like it's a cause and effect, right? Because the language in HR 1154 was specifically targeted to conspiracy theories, QAnon, things that didn't give the correct, you know, correct in quotes.
The Hunter Biden laptop.
Yeah. Exactly, that kind of stuff. So if you look at the timeline, it looks, I mean, to any logical or reasonable person, and look at this, these creators, many of them had been up on YouTube for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. So you mean to tell me that they're up there for 10 years, no one bothers them, they're flourishing, they're making money for themselves, for YouTube, getting millions of views. October 2nd, the House calls out their speech. October 15th takes it down. And they want us to believe that YouTube just suddenly had an epiphany and exercised their editorial discretion. I don't believe it. I don't think it's plausible.
I feel like it's willful ignorance to not draw that direct line to it. Craig, go ahead.
I just had one, you know, kind of an observation/question. I don't know how much you can comment on this, Chris, but It seemed to me as Judge Van Dyke, you know, in his kind of what he was giving us from, you know, examining your argument, kind of all but conceded the fact that they deleted us to affect the outcome of the 2020 election, you know, with that intent, explicit purpose. And it seemed to me as though he kind of had the, I don't know, I guess it just felt like he was basically saying they did it. And it's like, well, what can we do about it? And I know your argument is we have to prove that the government basically forced them to do it. But did you get the feeling that maybe Judge Van Dyke had a, you know, a more of a feel for what we're doing? I don't know how to put it, you know, without getting into kind of a realm that I don't know if you can get into.
Same impression too. Yeah. And I thought that was interesting that he kind of intimated that people generally think that that's exactly what happened.
And the question I had for him was, well, do you think that's okay or not? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think it'll be interesting what they say about the election, because we didn't really allege much to that in our pleadings. So it did feel like they were pulling out of air, but he does have a point. I'd also point out, just so you know, the composition of the panel. We had three judges up there. Judge McKeown, who is a very long respected member of the court, who's written many opinions, particularly in the area of YouTube is a private entity and not subject to the First Amendment, a very landmark case in that area that has been followed. She's very smart. She's very good. But I will note to you that the other two judges, Judge Callahan and Judge Van Dyke, were both conservative appointees, with Van Dyke having been appointed by Trump. Mm. One of the reasons we thought we had a stronger case in the Ninth Circuit in 2020, when we started this case, is because Trump appointed so many federal judges that were conservative that we thought we might have a chance. But I will note that the First Amendment is traditionally a liberal issue. I mean, I was on the board of the ACLU of Southern California years ago. And I mean, it's always been a liberal issue. So when you look at it, you know, the First Amendment should not be a liberal nor a conservative. The point of it is the unpopular speech is the one that's always going to be censored. And the political winds change, you'll be on the other end. And that's why it's so important to protect it, no matter, you know, which side of the political spectrum you're on.
It's interesting how far the ACLU has strayed from what they used to be. I mean, recently they've kind of been, you know, positive in terms of the criticism they've had for the way that Project Veritas has been treated. But in general, they seem to kind of be erring against free speech now. Sarah, go ahead.
Well, to that point, George Soros gave him $50 million, I think, in 2015. And since then, they shifted. But I had a board member from the ACLU come on and talk about that. But I do have a question for Chris. If they don't side with us in district court, what does that say about the standard? Because I know there was a case at the Supreme Court that with Bantam Books and other cases. What happens to the standard if they don't side with us? It seems like they'll make the standard so high that the government could always collude with YouTube or Google and no one could ever prove it, because of HR, you know, the resolution, what Nancy Pelosi said, the subpoena, the CEOs to Congress. If all of that isn't enough to even be able to be grant, you know, the chance to sue them, then it seems like nobody will be able to reach that threshold.
Well, Sarah, the truth is that, look, judges are very smart, and a smart lawyer, a smart judge can write an opinion, have it go one way or the other, and maybe not reach the key issue. The key issue here is, did we allege enough government interference that the case should go forward, that we should get to discover what really happened? I mean, I think that, you know, I can't predict what the court will say, but there's certainly, I can imagine, opinion where it does decimate the First Amendment. And what, you know, I told the court is, where is the boundary? At some point, the private entity stops to become a private entity when the government puts a gun to its head, which they did by saying, if you don't behave, we're going to take away your 230 immunity. I mean, Nancy Pelosi explicitly said that. So at what point, now, where's the boundary? We should know where the line is, when a private entity is a private entity and when the government interference is so pervasive that Americans should take note. So, you know, I don't know, you know, it really depends on what the decision is. But I can imagine a whole variety of different ways the government, the Ninth Circuit could reach various outcomes. But on the First Amendment issue, I mean, I think under the Supreme Court precedent, we are right. I really truly believe that. And if it rules on the First Amendment issue and the government interference issue, I think we've got a case that I would love to send up to the Supreme Court.
Could I just jump in here for a second and just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Chris, we were actually on that same oral argument schedule, my case as well.
I saw that.
Yeah, we got bounced out on a procedural. They said that we didn't do it timely enough. But have you considered substantial overbreath in terms of a First Amendment in going up to en banc? Because, you know, with it being a regulatory, you know, delegation of authority, it's gone well beyond its breadth.
No, that's not the case we brought. I mean, when you get to substantial overbreath, you're talking about a particular statute and how overbroad it is, and then it's drawn, you know, not tailored enough to protect the First Amendment. And we're not really talking about a particular statute here. We're talking about the conduct of the government in interfering with YouTube's editorial discretion.
You're on the other
side
of it.
So it's a different case. Yeah.
Okay. So you're on the other side.
We did not address 230 in this case. 230 may be a case that comes up, a matter that comes up later in the case, but we're not at 230 on this case right now.
Smart.
Jason, I'm not actually familiar with your case. Would you mind just introducing that to the audience?
Yeah.
Hey, you guys, thank you. Before you go on, sure. I'm gonna check out. But thank you very much, and thank you for your questions, and thanks for the nice comments. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
Chris.
And Jason, before we get to you, I do want to mention that we are doing a fundraiser for this lawsuit. Like, we're doing this lawsuit so we can protect, you know, the freedom of speech here in America, and it's very important because, you know, we need to be able to talk about, you know, political things like the Hunter Biden laptop and, you know, whether there's a conflict of interest with, you know, the president of the United States. And so I just want to remind everyone that we do have this fundraiser. We are fighting for you. And if you can please help us in our mission to do that, it'd be very very much well appreciated. I'm going to put that up in a little bit.
Absolutely. This always costs a lot of money. And I know that, you know, you guys have been in the fight as long as I have, you know, having come out with Google. And that's actually how I got introduced to Zach. But our direction is a little bit different. We went through 230 instead of around it. You know, I sued Facebook in 2018, took it all the way to the Supreme Court, never got a single day in court. And, like I said, I was actually in that same oral argument with a bit of a different issue. We had come back with what's called the general provision of the statute, what a lot of people don't know about. And the general provision is literally just that. It's general. It's supposed to preside over the whole thing. And what that means is they're supposed to be acting as a good Samaritan first, and they didn't do that. And the thing was is that we actually caught them in a catch 22, which was really kind of strange, where we said, hey, look, if this is the general provision, it's got to apply to the whole statute. But if it's not, there was a case recently, Jakarski versus the SEC, that said, if it's not the intelligible principle, it's unconstitutional. So either way, we would have won. And they decided to cancel oral arguments on us for the sixth time. And they blew it out on a procedural saying that we didn't, it wasn't timely. And that's not right. I mean, we're going to be going back at them because we have the schedule. But we also took a separate path, which is what you guys were originally talking about, which is we're going after the government itself. I essentially, because I lost in this all the way up at the Supreme Court, I had never gotten a day in court. Because this is a statutory delegation of authority, we decided to go after the government itself, and we brought a 143-page constitutional challenge against the government back in April. I have congressional support from Congressman Gohmert, but essentially, you know, Zach, us, you know, Chris, we're all just trying to get our voices back online. I mean, that's what this is all about, is supporting the people that are actually fighting it, you know?
That's right. Well, and, you know, I've talked to Chris about some of the stuff of, you know, different lawsuits and stuff. And she says, whoever can break through is great. And all these cases actually help each other, because the more pressure that's mounting, the more awareness they'll have as to what the real issues are.
It doesn't matter who wins.
You know, the judges.
We all win. Right. We all win if anyone wins.
Yeah. Once that precedent's been set. You know, and you know, I think that going after the government is an excellent idea. I mean, to Chris's point, obviously it's pretty difficult, but I mean, it's also pretty obvious to anybody who's taking a look. I mean, it's not just that House resolution, but I mean, I believe Adam Schiff had sent out a letter to a variety of social media companies prior to that, telling them specifically that he wanted certain types of speech to be taken off. Obviously, Mark Zuckerberg's revelation that the FBI stopped over and said, by the way, suppress anything having to do with the Hunter Biden laptop. I mean, it's pretty clear when you take a look at the behavior of certain individuals within the government and then even entire agencies. I'm actually pretty excited about what's going to come out of this Missouri lawsuit with Dr. Fauci and a whole host of federal agencies and executives getting deposed and getting discovery on their personal emails and communications.
And I want to add that, you know, this lawsuit keeps on getting easier in some ways because more facts keep making it out to the general public about the sort of fusion between what the government's doing and what big tech is doing. And what's really incredible is the amount of additional evidence that we're integrating into this lawsuit, because now it's, you know, now it's fact that there was a back channel between various members of the House, Adam Schiff in particular, who, you know, encouraged Google to do the censorship. And when we started this case, that wasn't something that we knew, it was something that we suspected. But now that it's coming to light, you know, one of the questions I have is, what are we going to discover, you know, in the next few months about the collusion between the state and big tech?
Oh, I think it's going to be worse than anybody even imagines, in my opinion. Let me just state really quick that I was going to say the government, we want to make sure that they don't hide, that Google doesn't get away with blaming the government for everything. And that's the only concern I have, is that you have to go over after Google too, and they don't do some kind of whitewash where the government's at fault in this situation, but then Google stays intact and then they can still work their agendas with other big players. That can't happen. So I think it's great that we're going after them from all different angles, but whatever happens, that can't happen. Otherwise, all we did is, you know, sweep it under the rug, and we paid it being the taxpayers.
No, you're absolutely right, because at this point, Google has, or YouTube rather, has changed their terms and conditions. And so based upon probably what they have in place today, what they did to us back in October of 2020 wouldn't have been against the rules, wouldn't have been against their own terms and conditions. But yeah, they have to pay the price for what they've done to us. I mean, there's a whole host of other things that we don't even address, you know, like tortious interference, you know, the taking our ability to make a living, our ability to continue to run our businesses. You know, this is something that I wanted to ask you guys about individually as well. I mean, this was devastating to me financially. This was devastating to me in terms of being able to reach my audience, to be able to, you know, even have the psychological wherewithal to continue. I mean, when I looked at my YouTube channel on October 15th, as I was getting my stream ready for a live appearance I was making that day in another city in another state, to see my channel wiped off the face of the earth and, you know, 800 plus videos just gone in an instant, you know, that really affected me. And it was like I had to take everything inside of myself to continue moving forward, you know, knowing that the election was just 2 weeks away. Craig, I mean, if you can comment on the personal cost to you, I'd really like to hear about it.
Well, the personal cost is huge. The toll was amazingly large. I had massive problems after my channel went down, financially, mental health, physical health, a lot of big problems for me in my life. But, you know, by the grace of God, I got through it. But I'll tell you this. I mean, the damages that I suffered through all of this were, you know, just immense. I mean, you can't imagine what it's like. I had actually been in South Florida. I was at Miami at the American Priority Conference when I received basically where I was on my way to it. And, you know, when I found out my channel was taken off, this was 2 weeks before the election. You know, the things that you go through when you lose your channel like that and your audience, especially when you built that into a career, it's almost indescribable. Because a lot of people be like, it's not a big deal. You lost your channel. Like, get over it. You know, you'll make it up. But no, it's huge, and it takes a huge effect on you. And at the end of the day, what I went through on a personal level was I was in the middle of making an HBO documentary with a friend of mine. We had been putting it together for three years. I'd been working on it, and it was not going to be launched until March or May of that year or of the next year. So I was kind of sitting there I think it was May of that year, but either way, I was sitting there thinking to myself, you know, this is just, what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to support my family? How am I going to pay my bills? How am I going to, and it all just came to this culmination where I had to like step away for a year. I wasn't able to make content for about a year where I literally couldn't do anything. I mean, I was in such a bad place mentally, physically, and it cost me a huge amount of my audience. You know, you guys like you, Zach, I know kept going, you know, hard. You, kept fighting through it, but some of us, you know, we had already been doing it for years, and it was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back for me, and it put me in a terrible place. It knocked me off my feet, and it took me about a year, but with God's grace, I was able to get my health order, my mental health in order, and get back on the horse, as it were. And now I'm struggling to rebuild that audience I once had. You know, it was one point I could get 50,000 views, you know, an episode, 100,000, 200,000, easy. It wasn't even like, that was like a daily episode for me. And now I'm you know, lucky to get 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 views on an episode. And that's like being lucky. So it's a process. You probably know just as well as everyone else, you know, Sarah and everyone else who went through this. But when you had a big channel like I did, and you did too, Zach, it's devastating because your advertisers leave. The revenue just drops through the floor. I have people now like, oh, you still exist? You're still around? Like, I didn't, you know, I didn't disappear. I was disappeared. The Matt, Matt Drudge, the digital gulag. We got thrown in the digital gulag and I'm still there. Banned on Twitter, banned on Facebook, banned on YouTube, banned on Indeed.com, banned me. MailChimp banned me. Oh, yeah. I've been banned on so many platforms. You can't even go. There's a list so long. I can't get on any major big tech platform, and they'll delete me as soon as they figure out who I am. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like being a second class citizen at that point, digitally at least. And then you have to rebuild. And if you want to keep your career in this particular focus, which is, you know, online digital content creation, it's almost impossible. But like I say, by the grace of God, his grace is greater. I'm able to persevere and go through and get to where I am now, which is just back to barely making a fraction of what I made previously. I probably lost 80% of my income, and I'm still struggling to get that 20%, you know, that I can for now.
No, I absolutely understand. My heart goes out to you. And I went through the same thing, but I had to persevere. I had to keep going, you know, but it was very difficult to do it. I mean, like every single day it was a struggle to get up and, you know, try to appear as if I was going to be okay. I basically just faked it till I made it. And yes, in the same way, the email that I used for YouTube was preemptively banned on every single platform that you could possibly imagine. Even my Proton Mail, which has Red Pill 78 in it, has been banned from a number of platforms that have nothing to do with content creation. Well, Shutterfly for stock footage, I was preemptively banned from that. I tried to sign up just to get a couple of videos that I wanted specifically. And as soon as I made the account, they immediately shut it down and they said, you're going to have to talk to customer service. And then, of course, they have nothing that they'll say to me because I didn't do anything wrong and they just don't want me there. Sarah, how about yourself? What was this like for you?
Well, I had my website taken. I had Patreon taken down, which I had a lot of followers. I had 1,800 subscribers there. So that was a good monthly income that I could count on. And then I had my website was taken down and I was turning it into a news site. Mm-hmm. And GoDaddy, the National Federal Crime Division, took down my website, me and the largest gun forum. And luckily, the employees at GoDaddy were horrified. They're like, we don't do stuff like this. And they got my domain back. And then I got it set up outside the country. And I was set up on sarahwestell.net for like 2 weeks. But I got it back. And now I'm set up and out of the country in a different area. But it's just Twitter. Of course, I was taken down the same day all of us were taken down, along with Donald Trump. Same day. But it was... I think it I just kind of went into a different zone And I had a very similar, not similar, very different, but a really very difficult situation back in 2008 with my business and a corrupt bank. And I learned a lot about the banking industry and the law, you know, legal injustice and all this stuff in the government. And that was horrifying for me. And so I already went through this really hard situation. And so it was very hard for me, but that toughened me up a lot. And so if I hadn't done that first, then I think I would have, I don't know if I would have continued. I mean, I don't know. It was, that would have been devastating. But because I already went through that, that allowed me to be a little stronger because I already got destroyed. You know what I mean? By a very corrupt bank. That's a whole nother story. But it was really devastating. I think we all went through a lot. And the biggest concern I have is that if Google and just big tech in general, Google I'm the most worried about because I understand the size and scope of them. They have 92% of the world's search engine market, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're a monopoly worldwide. I mean, not just in the United States. And the fact that they control the narrative of the young people. I mean, we're a little older, so we remember and we go to newspapers or sites and look elsewhere. They live in this social media bubble. And they're fed what they're fed. And I'm very concerned that if this is allowed, we in the world, we're going to see freedom. We're going to see tyranny at a level we've never experienced. And so it's very serious. And we can't let them sweep it under the rug and let the government pay for their crimes through taxpayers. We'll end up paying for it. And then Google still stays intact with this Section 230, and then a powerful entity can sit and manipulate them all day long. We can't have that if we want to maintain freedom. And I think Zach Borys, the Google whistleblower, I think you can speak to that quite well. I'm hoping you and you guys can speak to that really well when you go on a Caravan to Midnight on Monday, because people need to understand how dangerous Google really is, and big tech in general is, but Google in particular is very scary.
Well, I think that one of the, you know, the positive things about this is that we have now sort of established alternatives, big tech. And that fills the gap a little bit. YouTube is a massive platform. That's where the users are. If you want to find out how to do anything, like today, I figured out how to do some technical thing for a social media site that I'm contracted to work on, that you guys will see soon, very soon here. And, the go-to was YouTube. I didn't go to Rumble. I didn't go to BitChute. The information store is on YouTube. And that recommendation engine is really powerful. And the thing is that people want this conservative content. They do not like the lies that are being shoveled to them by this like collusive force. People want to hear what's, alternative viewpoints. They want to have a different narrative on the news. And so what was really happening was, and I saw this from the inside as when I was working at YouTube, is look, like those clicks are driving the recommendation algorithm. And who's ever sitting behind Google decided that this wasn't going to be in their favor. And so what they did is instead of trying to come up with better ideas, they just said, we're going to shut down the voices of those with better ideas, and they did it right before the election. Like, where's the election, regulatory body? Like they're letting the entire thing go through. Like at the very least, Google should be, sued by the government right now for election interference, right? Like, all this talk about get money out of politics. Well, this is the biggest force of money in politics. Like Google's over $1 trillion, and they're sitting there saying you can talk, you can listen to this person, but you can't consensually listen to that person, or you can't hold this, this viewpoint. And look, I don't agree with everything that, like, for example, Kanye West says, but you can't even put a video of him now on your Google Drive account. Google will tell you, they'll cancel your upload and they'll say, this content is not allowed. It violates our terms of service, and they block you from being able to upload it.
That's wild. Right.
It's wild. And they've done the same thing over and over and over again. Like when, there was the recount in Arizona, people were hosting their spreadsheets on the Google Drive account, and Google deleted them, basically said, this is ours now. You're running our servers. We don't like you accessing this spreadsheet, so we're just going to delete it, essentially, or, you know, essentially block access. And, you know, we have to fight back against this, because if we don't, then we're no better than, you know, a communist nation like China, which blocks all, you know, communications that it doesn't like. It's got an AI sensor. And that's essentially where we're at right now, is that we have an AI censorship regime that's, you know, been built into the infrastructure, and it's censoring you based upon criteria that literally changes overnight. Like the 4 a.m. talking points go out to the mainstream media, they change the narrative, and then Google, you know, modifies the rankings of all the search results on YouTube and Google Search and Google News to reflect that bias, which is the reason why, you know, I got together, you know, with these content creators and launched this campaign, which was originally called Punch Google, but now Sarah Westhall has taken over fundraising, and she's done a fantastic job with that, which is right here at the givesendgo.com/defendingfreedom.com. Check it out. It's got a lot of the content that, you know, from this case that we're posting here. And a lot of people are coming out and saying, I want to contribute to this, right? $57,000 already. That's incredible. That's an incredible number. And I want to, you know, give a hand to Sarah. I have been talking for a little bit longer, but I will say that, you know, do we have any time, Zach, to show some of these clips of the trial? Because the trial was pretty amazing. Like, I was pretty much glued to, you know, all the arguments. I thought Chris Armenta, you know, delivered an incredibly strong case, and the judges were, you know, exploring, you know, the relationship between, you know, what government officials, you know, and their private communications with these big tech, you know, with Google in particular, and the censorship regime that followed. So I'd like to show some clips from that, and then, you know, get your commentary, Zach, get your commentary, Greg, Sarah, Jason, on, you know, what some of this stuff means, because there's a lot of things here that, you know, just to be honest, go over my head.
Yeah, that's totally fine. I think that's very valuable. I streamed the proceedings the other day, and I gave my thoughts on a lot of what the judges had to say in the interaction. So I would love to get the thoughts from the other panelists. But please go ahead, cue it up.
I just want to interject real quick, if I could, that, you know, we knew that it was going downhill. I mean, before all this happened, do you guys remember when you couldn't say Eric Chiamarella?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Do you remember that? I remember that. That's when I knew that this was all going south, was when I had a video pulled because I said that guy's name.
Yep.
And, you know, what these hearings, it's not a trial, Zach, it's hearings, but or a hearing to hear the argument. But what this essentially shows, which I'm sure you'll show, is that, you know, like I said, Judge Van Dyke on the right there, the male judge of this three panel judge board, he essentially just validates the claim that we've made from day one, which is that they did this to fix the election. We knew it. They knew it. The judges know it. They're essentially telling us in these hearings, in no uncertain terms, what are you going to do about it? And I really think that's the point that we need to, like, if we're going to take anything away from this, these judges are saying, yeah, they did it. So what? You don't have any case against us, and or against them, because they're a private entity and they can do this. And I think that's something that cannot be stressed any more than I could here, to say that, you know, that was my ultimate takeaway. Although I do have hope for our case, and I do think we have standing, and I do think we have a case to be made, and we will win. I just think that the judges are kind of, you know, in the way they play the devil's advocate, saying, well, what are you going to do about it? And I think that, you know, let's watch these clips. But I knew at that point with Eric Chiamarella where it was headed, and I knew that our channels were doomed from that moment. And I'm not surprised where we're at now.
Okay, Zach, what is the first clip?
My ninth grader is studying Fahrenheit 451 in English. So I thought I would start with that, which is the case in which Ray Bradbury wrote of a dystopian society in which firemen, instead of putting out fires, they burned books and sometimes the people along with them, in the interest of creating conformity and squelching independent thought. In this case, YouTube is the book burner, and it's the government officials and the House of Representatives itself that identified for YouTube which books to burn. The plaintiffs allege that the public officials, through H.R. 1154, specifically identified the speech that plaintiffs had been making for years on YouTube. It was the escalating threats that public officials made out loud. Nancy Pelosi said that she would take away, or she would attempt to take away, Section 230 immunity. YouTube hopped to it, and we allege that they did it as a result of both coercion and encouragement.
One thing that's kind of weird about this is you don't have anything really in the record about what they took down. I mean, we can track it down, but then it's not really in the record, which seems kind of bizarre to me that you're making us work that hard on that. So I'm just not sure why there aren't more specific allegations relating to the specific content.
Fair
that's
point.
At issue here.
Fair point, Your Honor. There are a few allegations in the First Amendment complaint, and I think we admit in our brief they could have been much more detailed. Part of that reason
is... Well, we're just kind of human beings. We wonder what we're taking down.
Sure, of course. So if you look at ER 59, paragraph 8 of the First Amendment complaint does talk about conspiracy theories, talks about content about Hunter Biden in the Ukraine, the ongoing corruption probe, content about social media censorship, content about QAnon. That's right in the complaint. It's also, some of those are the specific issues that were identified in H.R. 1154. So there's a direct link between what the House of Representatives identified, what the plaintiff's content was, and then, curiously, exactly what YouTube put in their blog on October 15th.
Well, let me ask you. Let's assume there's all that and more. The question is, does it matter? Because what I think is lacking here, and maybe you can point me to it, I don't see any congressional command. And I don't see anything that links it with YouTube, for example, where it appears that your client's writings took place. Do you have any allegation you can make on that other than what you've made?
I think, Your Honor, if we decide that Blum and Bantam Books and all the other cases required a congressional demand, then we're really taking the heart out of those cases where the Supreme Court said that encouragement, threats, coercion is enough. And so the question really is were there threats and encouragement and coercion enough that, as the case law is, that the private action should be fairly attributed to the state?
Now, you have a couple members of Congress, and we know they are not Congress.
Right.
And I think your clients would probably agree with that.
Yes, of course.
So you have a couple of people who have made statements. That can't be a compulsion, can it?
No, it can't. And we saw that in
What else is there then?
Let me explain where I think the line should be, because
All right.
I think it's very important to identify that line, if not in this case, perhaps if the case comes back. And that's this. We saw in Abu Jamal, Senator Dole didn't like a program that was going up. That wasn't enough. We saw in a case, Elizabeth Warren criticized an Amazon book. That's not enough, because after all, the legislators do have their own First Amendment rights to say what they think. You know, we see that a lot, and that's absolutely fair game.
But what is your best case?
When you have an S. Bantam Books, 1963. In Bantam Books, a New Jersey commission identified what publications it didn't like, and the publishers decided to stop circulating those books. And they did that because they were afraid of some unspecified action that could befall them. It wasn't a mandate. They weren't threatened with anything specific. In this case, by the way, YouTube was threatened with something very specific. They were threatened with the takeaway of the lifeblood of their business, which was the repeal of 230. Now that alone is.
Okay. So, I guess this is a question for you, Jason. What is Bantam Books, and how does it apply to this case that we're doing right now?
I'll be honest, I'm not familiar with Bantam Books. I have a take on what they're saying there. They were talking about the line. Excuse me. They're looking for an arbitrary line to say where is it coercion and where is it not coercion? And we look at it a little bit differently. Obviously, we're, you know, we're running concurrent cases. We look at it from the standpoint that the line actually exists and the coercion exists in the statute itself at the beginning. And the reason being is because if you just look at its title alone, right, for this is Section 230's title, it's protection for Good Samaritan blocking and screening of offensive materials. Well, the government gave them a directive. They're giving them protection to do a job, and that's to protect blocking and screening of offensive materials. So the government physically gave them a direction, like a directive at the beginning. And that's the way we approached it and say that what they're saying here is from outside sources, if they just, you know, intimate, you know, like, well, we don't like this. Is that enough? Well, the point there is that that's an outside directive, not in the direct, you know, not in the actual statute. In that circumstance, it's very hard to pin it on them, you know, as to because it's what we call it's just a laundering process. They say, hey, we would kind of like you to do this. And then they go, oh, OK, wink, wink, nod, nod. You know, we won't take away your protections if you do what we tell you to do. Otherwise, we'll take them away and we'll decimate the entire industry. It's yes, it is coercion, but making that jump, that leap is tough because the judges don't want to connect it. That's the way we look at it. They don't want to make that connection. It's very tough.
I can speak to Bantam Books if you if you want me to, because I've been talking to Chris a little bit about, you know, the case. She kind of bounced some stuff off of me before the hearing and stuff just to, because I would ask her questions and things. But the Bantam Books was a case in New York where, you know, in the 50s, 59, I think, I don't know. I don't remember what year it was. It was either the 68 or 58. I can't remember. But anyways, it was a situation where the government had a council and they wanted to ban certain books. And they came up with a list. Chris explained it. And then they had a police officer deliver this list to the distributors, and the distributors immediately took it off, saying that there were that, you know, they actually said they wanted to do it, but they ended up suing, and a different entity ended up suing. I think it was the publisher or the book writers. I'm not exactly sure who ended up suing. Okay, but I know the point of the case. They said that it didn't matter whether they wanted to or not do it. But they did it because of the fear of what could happen if they didn't take it down. And that's what the argument was. And the Supreme Court agreed with that argument, saying that the it was authoritative enough, it was coercive enough, it was official enough that it scared the distributor into doing it immediately. And that it was of concern. And so it was as if they were acting as a state actor at that point because of the coercive nature. You know, they talk about the gun to the head and the coercion and stuff. In our case, and so the Supreme Court decided on that. In our case, we have, you know, HR 1154. We have the CEOs up on Congress. We have Adam Schiff. We have Nancy Pelosi. We have a whole bunch of things. And our case is so much stronger than Bantam Books. And so if they ruled against it, that's why she says there's a good Supreme Court case here if they rule against it, because now they're going against the standard set at the Supreme Court. And if they end up turning that standard around, they're essentially getting rid of that whole state actor, and Google can do whatever they want under, I mean, because how could you create a standard higher?
A human catastrophe is closing in. Nobody knows how far this one is going to go. You can feel the heat as tension is rising globally. War is expensive. Open a Noble Gold Investments IRA today, and you can claim a free 3-ounce silver American Virtue coin. Just use the promo code GOLD. Go to NobleGoldInvestments.com now.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Than that. I mean, that's about as high as you're ever going to get. And they, well, in history, in American history, that's the highest standard that's ever happened. So the chance of it happening again is pretty rare. And so that's why this is a good case.
Was this the case that established the quasi-state actor where the government made the request, but there was another entity that actually did the execution of that censorship?
Well, this was Bantam Books was the distributor, and they pulled all those books down because they're worried about what the government was going to do. And so that's why that was, you know, that was the case. So did I answer that question?
Well, it was 1963.
I'm not an attorney, so I'm not using the proper words, but I think the concept and the logic is there.
It was 1963, and it was a state commission that was basically stating that you couldn't publish these objectionable things. They had the police try to shut it down. It was basically, I guess that's what they brought to the court. The court argued that, you know, it was censorship by state action, and that I don't know how that relates to state action as far as what you're asking, Zach, but I just wanted to correct. It was 1963.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't have the right year. I couldn't remember the year, but yeah. So this was, that's our best case because it matches, or at least Chris thinks it's our best case because it matches exactly what happened here. And the Supreme Court already ruled on that as, you know, a matter of standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is kind of like
ours interesting... is worse than that.
Yeah, it exceeds that. And the thing that's interesting is that, you know, they've got this sort of thing where it's like, you know, if you were to sue the government, they're like, well, we didn't ban you. Go sue Google, and you go to Google, and like, well, we got coerced. You know, go sue the government, and so they point
these
fingers.
That's exactly what happened to us, Zach.
Yeah,
we didn't sue the government. They blamed it on Facebook, and Facebook blamed it on the government, and it just goes around in a circle.
Right.
But that's why it's important to do the state actor thing like this, because otherwise they both point at each other and both cases go away and you're hosed.
Mm-hmm. Can I continue with another clip?
Go ahead. Before you do, let me say this, and then Craig, you do it, and then Zach, you do your clip. Freight Awakening over on Rumble said, great panel, Zach. Craig, along with Praying Medic, were who I found when I wanted to learn what Q was all about almost 5 years ago. They led me to you and many others. Zach has balls of steel. Salute. I don't know if you're talking about me or Zach Voorhees, but I'll accept. Freight Awakening also says, hopefully you get to the rants at one point, Zach. If not, no biggie. But I missed Craig's secret to perfect fried chicken a month or so ago. Maybe he can divulge it now or share a link. Google is asshole. So, Craig, I will allow you to either decline or accept and make your other point.
You can have my secret to fried chicken. It's on YouTube at Crespies. I'll leave a link in the chat in a minute here. But I was just going to make a point on the beginning of that clip you showed just a second ago, Zach Voorhees, that, you know, the funny thing was when you heard the judge ask, she says, it's amazing that you haven't given us any, you know, provided us with any direct examples of, you know, of what the content one that was deleted or that we're supposed to be looking at. I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, they deleted all of our content. Like, how are we supposed to get it to you? Like, it's like they memory hold it. And now you want us to go find out what, you know, what particular content of the thousands of hours of content that we made. It was the particular, you know, argument for the case. It's insane. The whole logic is backwards. And how these courts work, if you ask me, is because the whole system seems rigged. But go on, Zach.
That's I just want to say, eject. That's a really good point to make in your en banc refiling.
That's what I was
saying. The content's not there because you took it away. I can't even show you.
That was exactly what I thought. And I was hoping that Chris would end up bringing it up at some point, but, you know, perhaps in the next hearing.
Yeah, I was hoping she would. I was hoping she would, too.
All right, here we go.
Go ahead.
The combination of forces that caused external pressure on YouTube, as I think Judge Callahan wrote the opinion in UC in Doe versus Regents, where you have a number of forces that create pressure and reaction. So the question is, did the plaintiffs allege that there was enough pressure and the specific identification of the speech in question that YouTube reacted? Well, it's very simple to find that because all you have to do is look at the timeline. The House passed its resolution on October 2nd, 2020. It identified the specific content. The plaintiffs' channels had been up for years. YouTube never before identified conspiracy theories, QAnon, Hunter Biden's laptop, or any of those things. And suddenly, they want us to believe that October 15th, YouTube had this sudden epiphany that they wanted to exercise their First Amendment rights that they hadn't done in years and years and years. The only thing that you can see is that HR 1154 that identified that specific speech was passed on October 2nd. The government's not allowed to identify by formal resolution specific speech that it wants social media to take down. I mean, this wouldn't matter if it was a private library or if it's social media. The point is the government, in a formal way, which has been followed up, by the way, by written threats, not only audible threats, but also a writing and an admission by YouTube that it was acting on the censorship issue in partnership
in but, partnership.
Okay, so reactions. What do you guys think about that? Like, you guys got censored. I mean, now in retrospect, it was very clear. Yeah, it all happened when the Hunter Biden laptop story broke. And you guys were all over that immediately. And boom, it was just like every single one of your channels was taken down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even before the YouTube deletion, I mean, there was a series of progressive deletions. I mean, Sarah mentioned Patreon, PayPal, Cash App. You know, and then just shortly after getting deleted from YouTube, I got deleted from Twitter, like, you know, less than 2 weeks later before the election as well. So, I mean, it seems pretty clear that there is a direct correlation between that additional pressure that was put from the government onto YouTube to suddenly have this shut down. And I think it becomes even clearer when you have the Federal Bureau of Investigation visiting Facebook and saying to them, hey, guess what, guys? We don't want this getting out. Are we to believe that Facebook was the only social media company that the FBI paid a visit to? I highly doubt it. And I would imagine that you're going to find a record of them also visiting Twitter and a record of them also visiting YouTube and probably any number of other social media companies.
Well, and I think also you got to remember they had a target on our back for the whole time. And they were looking for any reason. It wouldn't have mattered. It could have been like, oh, we sneezed and oh, yeah, you're gone. But they chose to do it because I believe wholeheartedly that we were talking about Susan Wojcicki and Sergey Brin and their incestuous relationship and how they're all interconnected and in their relationships and how, you know, Google and 23andMe are connected. And did anybody know that before we started digging on those things? And did people realize that they're harvesting your DNA and then is connecting it to your social profiles? And did they know that, you know, Facebook was LifeLog and that, you know, the CIA basically handed this program to Mark Zuckerberg to run with? And did they know any of these things before we started reporting on them? And the answer to that is probably no.
Right.
And then once you realize that, then you realize very quickly that it wasn't just Hunter Biden's laptop. They were just looking for an excuse to get rid of us. And HR 11, whatever it was, the one that Nancy Pelosi and then put out, was just the convenient excuse that they were looking for. But it was coercion, because if you look at it, the government was saying, if you don't get rid of these people, we're going to start, you know, changing your protections, right? We're going to have to take a hard look at your protections, you know, your Section 230 protection, which I don't know how they still qualify for receiving anyway, because they've become publishers and editors in the way that they, you know, curate content on their platform. And just the fact that when you go to search on Google and you get the same results on every page for the first like 100 page or 200 pages, and you realize the internet's dead. It's not the Wild West it once was. It's some, you know, shallow, hollow, you know, shell of what it once was, which was you could go online, you could find information that you wouldn't otherwise be able to access in other places, especially from the mainstream media. And when we broke the system, I remember when I started, I was beating CNN like a drum on a regular basis with my one channel. One episode of my channel would knock, I mean, I wouldn't beat CNN in aggregate, but there wasn't a show on CNN that could compete with me numbers wise until they started manipulating the algorithms, until they started deplatforming and putting us in these, you know, they wouldn't suggest our content and they wouldn't promote our content. And then they took us out of the carousel and then they took us, demonetized us. Until all that stuff started happening, I mean, me and Zach, I know you were doing great too, because you were like, you were moving quick, man. I remember every time I look at your channel, you'd have like 10,000 more subscribers. I'd be like, who is this guy? And then I started watching. I'm like, this guy's pretty good. Like, I better step my game up. This guy's coming for me, right?
He's going to like overpass me.
And you eventually did, God bless you. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, they had it out for us because we were doing stuff that they were scared of. I remember when my channel first started, you know what I was researching back in 2017 and 2016 even? I was researching Hunter Biden, Burisma Capital, Devin Archer. Those were the things that I was researching and I was making videos about and putting you know, deep dives into. And it's like, well, then it makes sense in 2023 years later why as soon as Hunter Biden gets out, you got to disappear the people who know where the bodies are buried,
right?
Because we're going to be able to expose all this stuff. So, you know, that's the way I look at it.
You're absolutely right.
Jason, didn't you have millions and millions of followers, something like that?
Yeah. So we were kind of like the OG group. I got into it in like 2010. And I remember doing an accounting of my Facebook, you know, fans. We were at 16.8 million in 2012. We could actually change national trends, and I did in a couple circumstances. And it's funny because you guys were talking about that, and I can give, you know, your viewers. I don't know if I don't have it on my screen, but I have it on my cell phone. But I'm going to see if you can see this. That is what it looks like when everything shuts off.
Oh yeah.
And what that represents is that second number up is
ugly.
That's 40,000 likes a day I was gaining. Instantaneously, it just shut off.
Wow.
I went from making 300 grand a month to making six overnight. It dropped to four after that. And basically, there's nothing I could do about it. Wow. And it wasn't until 2018, it was, 16. Ironically, October 19th, you know, right before the election again, I lost six pages, 14 million fans overnight with no reason. But in that circumstance, I caught them in a catch-22. And this is where things get kind of hairy, because when they shut my content down, you know, they can claim that it's offensive, right? You don't know what's offensive. You can't prove that your stuff wasn't offensive, because they can consider anything offensive, right? But in that circumstance, I had a friend of mine who was an ex-colleague who did 22 million in advertising that year with them, and they had reps, and they went to the reps and said, "Hey, Facebook, you know, could you turn this guy's pages back on?" And they said, no, we can't do that. But if you guys own it, we can do it. So I sold them the pages. And sure enough, as soon as I inked those contracts, boom, they all came back. Now, the thing was, the content was identical when it went down as when it came back. So we caught them dead to rights. It has nothing to do with content. And yet we have now spent, 4 years in the California courts. We've made arguments that are irrefutable. And they come up with some of the craziest answers. You know, they basically have applied, and I found this in a study for the internet. It was some sort of study that was done over 500 cases over the last two decades, right? They have dismissed. You would think that most of them apply to C2, the part where you remove content. Believe it or not, out of 500 cases, only 19 cases have ever applied to 230C2. 481 of them applied to 230C1 because they said that you can't treat them as a publisher. And that happened, that's starting back in 1997 in Zaran. And so what happens is, if you can't treat them as a publisher, they can do anything they want with publishing so long as a third party created it. So much so that they could create the content, send it to a third party, have the third party post it, and claim, "We're immune because you can't make us a publisher." But in every one of what you guys are talking about, they are content providers, suggestions, sponsors, all of that stuff. It's making editorial decisions as to what content to provide. And yet you can't, because the courts have it misunderstood, you can't treat them as a publisher. But ironically, that's textually wrong. Mm-hmm. It says you can't treat them as the publisher. And in that case, the publisher is a specific publisher that's not them. They've got it wrong. They just won't deal with it. That's the problem. It undoes a lot of precedent.
It's almost like George Carlin was right when he said there's a big club and we ain't in it.
Yep.
That and Bill Clinton said, it depends on what the definition of is. The words matter, you know? Yeah.
True.
Yep. Well, and that's why it's so good that we do have a case like Bantam Books, because now they have their own precedent. They're going to go against the Supreme Court ruling. And so, I don't know. You know, judges can be, that's why I keep saying pray for the judges, because they can be bought out, blackmailed, whatever. We just need to make sure they have the courage to do what's right.
Can I make a prediction? Just because I literally just experienced it Thursday. We got a decision. Like I said, we were supposed to be in the same oral argument. We hit them with an absolute catch-22 argument that there was no way out of. And like I said, the Good Samaritan provision either had to apply to the whole statute, or it was unconstitutional if it wasn't the Good Samaritan general provision. It was a catch-22. There's no way out. And that was when they switched to procedural dismissal. They said, "Nope, you screwed up. You're out."
Wow.
It's because they couldn't argue it. That's how it goes. So, yeah, we may reply to them. But, you know, just like you guys, man, I don't care who wins this thing. All I want it done is fixed. But yeah, we're, you know, a lot of us are heading towards the Supreme Court, because I think that's the only place this can be fixed.
Well, and I keep kind of reminding myself, we started all this in October of 2020, just us in our case, particularly speaking. And it's almost like they're trying to run out the clock. And then they're like, okay, well, if you can't afford to play this game, then you're not going to have a chance, especially because it's like, how are we going to afford it if we have to sit here for years and years and years with lawyers and lawyers and lawyers going to court, case after court, hearing after hearing after hearing, then appeal after appeal. It is like they're running out the clock, and so they'll just keep changing the game up on us as we go. It's what it feels like.
It's a war of attrition. They want to run me out. They want to run you guys out, and that's why, like, everybody listen right now. Seriously, if you guys want us to fix this, like, this is who you donate to, like, because Zach and these guys, you know, Sarah and Craig, and we're actually doing the real fight. You know, they need your help. That's why you need to donate to them, because this is a war of attrition.
Right. Yeah, everyone's like, they're like, what can I do to help? And it's just like, we're doing the work. You know, we're doing the legwork. Sarah's, you know, been taking the torch and moving forward with this. And, you know, we're going to make sure that the freedom of speech is not just, you know, some obscure thing in the Constitution. It's something that actually protects you so that we can have a free and fair society, not only for ourselves, but also for our children and generations to come.
I tell people the freedom of speech, Zach, doesn't end where the internet begins. It goes all the way through. Like, that's why this is so important.
Yep, absolutely. And I'm going to play this video. We're going to see the tail end of this, arguments by Chris Armenta.
Okay, but let's assume that what everything that you say is enough for state action. Doesn't that just create a situation where you can hold the government responsible, not necessarily the private actor? Because it seems to me that you're alleging that, and if we agreed with you on that, then that would bring the government in. But I don't see any case out there. It seems to me you're asking us to push it even a step further and say, therefore, then the private actor is responsible.
And we are asking that, Your Honor, and that's because
that a step further than am I missing something?
That is a step, but it's not further than the existing law. So in the cases that we cite in our brief, Collins versus Woman Care, Brunetti versus Humane Society, and even in the court, the Ninth Circuit, that when the private actors essentially act as agents of the state or do the state's bidding, as we contend they've done here, their conduct is transformed into that of the state and they can be held responsible.
Yeah. So, you know, as she said right there, you know, the Google's acting as a quasi state actor. And that's the part where they're overstepping their boundaries and getting into a situation where, you know, essentially the government is regulating speech. And, you know, obviously they're doing this, you know, well, shouldn't Google be the one that you're suing? And, you know, the answer to that is no, you know, Google's the one that banned all you guys. And, you know, this is the entity that we need to face head on. And, you know, get this changed. What are your guys' thoughts?
I agree. We should go after Google just because, you know, like you said earlier, it's like they're just going to keep pointing the finger at each other. So it doesn't really matter, you know, one way or the other, except for the fact that Google is really the bad guy in all of this. As much as I want to, you know, be upset at the government for what they've done, the government's going to do what they're going to do. And they have a much higher degree of probability that they will get away with it. But if we allow corporations to become the government, like it's starting to slowly creep into every single day, then we're all screwed. And that's why I think it's important to have this individual accountability be on the corporation and their decision making, because these algorithms need to be exposed. We have to have discovery. We have to get to the bottom of how they rig this stuff, because if we don't, they're just going to keep doing it. And it's only going to get worse until all you see is Mr. Beast videos. And, you know, you're never going to be able to freaking have a conversation about anything, because, you know, you're just going to be inundated with all this garbage and nonsense that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't affect change societally, except for the change that they want to see, which is us, you know, slogged in front of a computer, you know, slurping McDonald's McFlurries while we, you know, slowly die of diabetes and cancer. So I think, you know, there's something to be said for this fight that has to be, you know, put forth for the people to see. There has to be transparency. Sunlight's best disinfectant. Expose these people. They're all incestuous relationships. Trust me. If you look at Sergey Brin, Susan Wojcicki, her sister, who was she married to? Oh, was it Sergey Brin? Oh, let's go look behind the curtain at these little families that seem to run the whole world. And they convince us that we should be hating each other because of the, you know, color of our skin and the, you know, whatever it is. So I'm totally against that. I'm a Christian, obviously. I'm all for Christ and God and putting that back in the equation. And then after that, we have to expose the evil that is on this world. It's like a cancer. You got to take it out.
Yep.
Very my opinion. Kind of an odd result, right? Because under your theory, Google really, really doesn't want to do this, but they just feel compelled to do it because of the government. So now we're going to, you know, add insult to injury and punish Google because the government made them, you know, under your theory. That just seems like an odd result. It seems like you would punish the government for forcing Google to do something, not punish Google for being forced.
I see what you're saying, Your Honor, but I would say that that's not necessarily the conclusion. We've pled it in the alternative because until we look under the hood on this, I don't know. Were they acting in partnership, as Susan Wojcicki tweeted?
Let me get at that for a second, because that's what I think. I mean, that's what you actually think, and that's what a lot of people think, is that Google actually wants to take this stuff down, right? Is that Google, I suppose best case for you, Google's taking this stuff, you know, Google's thankful for the government asking them to do it so they can kind of have a little bit of a reason to do it. But if Google wants to take this down, you have a plausibility standard at the motion to dismiss stage, right, under Iqbal and Twombly. So why is it not equally plausible? We have other cases that are challenging, you know, there's this national news that these folks like Google and Facebook, that they are deplatforming, deplatforming conservatives. So, I mean, why is it not equally or more plausible that Google just wants to take these folks down and wants to do it just before, you know, you say, well, the timing's suspect here, but it's not suspect. It's right before the election.
Well, it's right before the election, and it's right after the passage of H.R. 1154 that specifically called out that specific kind of speech. So I don't think it's plausible, even though that's not a defense that was in the pleadings. And again, we have to go.
But if that is what Google and these other platforms are doing, I think a lot of people would agree with you that's problematic.
Yes.
But is the fix this, or is the fix some regulations that stop them from stomping on people?
Well, I think
and regulating content.
Until we know the answer, we really have very little for anyone to go ahead and pass a regulation. We all
This is the thing. There is all of this like circular logic that they have, you know, like, oh, you know, why isn't it this or shouldn't it be this? But there is no precedent because they don't allow us to create any. Everything gets kicked out. Nobody wants to deal with any of the underlying issues, and everybody just keeps passing the buck. You know, I don't think that it's mutually exclusive that perhaps Google decided that they wanted to delete certain types of content, or that the government decided that they wanted to put pressure on them to do so, or that there are some behind the scenes relationships going on. I mean, it's all happening at the exact same time, and it's just a perfect storm, a confluence of events that allowed for them to do what they wanted to do, to support the type of speech they wanted to support, and for the government to control the speech that was allowed on the internet.
Agreed.
So let's create the precedent. Yeah, allow it.
Well, but we do have the precedent with the precedent with the ban of books and other things. And I think it's the good point that Jason said, freedom of speech doesn't end when you go online. Mm-hmm. There isn't like this artificial line that freedom of speech stops. That same case law should apply.
Oh, I think you're right. I think you're right. But it just sounds like perhaps the judges doubt whether or not it's actually applicable, when it seems to me clearly that it is.
Well, that's why she said, go ahead.
I was going to say,
that's why she says we have such a good case if we do the en banc hearing and we get more of the conservative judges, or if we bump it up to the Supreme Court, we have a really good case there too. Because that's why she said, right. You know, it's almost honest, made for it. But here, I don't know.
Excuse me, but the problem here is you have a bunch of septuagenarians like Chuck Grassley trying to dictate to us, like, oh, I'm going to fix all this. It's like, you don't even know how YouTube works. You couldn't even open a YouTube page if you tried. Yeah. And you're trying to tell us how we're going to regulate social media. These guys don't know what they're doing. And the people who do know what they're doing either are nefarious and insidious and you know, aren't part of it, or they are just ignored and they're squashed and they don't have a voice in Congress because they're not in the little club that you got to be on to get on the K Street bankroll to, you know, get your special interest group to support your campaign, and they don't matter enough. So let's just be honest about this. The whole thing's a joke, especially when you have these judges. You know, look at them. Look at the average age on that bench. I mean, who knows what it is? It's probably like 65, maybe. Let's be honest here with the two ladies. And you're trying to tell me that these are the guys who are going to understand the nuances of a digital communication and what it is in relation to like the print media, which they probably still get the New York Times. You know what I mean? They don't use YouTube like we do. They don't understand the internet, its ubiquity and how it's an evolving landscape that's changing. And that's so easily manipulated. And that once you catch them doing one crime, guess what? They just stop doing that crime. And then they create a new algorithm to commit another crime. So it's like it's like you're basically chasing the goalposts here. They just keep shifting them around. You're like, oh, I'm going to sue you for this. And they're like, well, we don't do that anymore. We changed the algorithms. You're like, oh, great. Yeah. Now I got to sue you for something else.
Right. And then on top of that, you know, I mean, the cost and the human capital that goes into getting us to the point that we're at right now. You're right, Sarah. I think we do have a great argument. And that would be awesome if the en banc panel solves it, or if we were able to get it to the Supreme Court to solve it as well. But I mean, that's a tremendous expense. And your average person who is also affected by this just simply doesn't have the time or the resources to get to this point. So again, you know, very important why we need help getting there, because this does affect every single one of us.
Until we know the answer, we really have very little for anyone to go ahead and pass a regulation. We all know that many laws and regulations are born out of outcomes and cases. And in this case, I think that the public and we are all entitled to know exactly what happened between the passage of H.R. 1154 and how YouTube suddenly...
Let me ask you this. So I hear what you're saying, but how is this lawsuit going to help them? Are you thinking that if you can get to discovery or something, you can get emails from between Nancy Pelosi and the CEO of Google saying, let's do this? Or,
I mean, I think we'll see what the internal machinations are. For instance, you're talking about things that were up on the news. So last month, Zuckerberg testified that they got a directive from the FBI to take down anything related to Hunter Biden's laptop, right? And if you look at H.R. 1154, it's directing the FBI.
But if Google didn't want to do this, wouldn't Google's attorney, and we'll hear from her in a second, wouldn't she come up here and say, yeah, we really didn't want to do this either, but we were forced to do it, and you guys would be walking hand in hand?
Well, that would be great if this was a summary judgment motion and she was under oath or this was a trial, but she's not.
But, you know, the other problem is, even if the House resolution had some binding impact, which it doesn't, it doesn't seem to track your case, because what you say, well, the FBI is directed to do something. No, all the FBI is, it encourages them to strengthen their focus on preventing violence and threats and extremism. Nothing in here even talks about YouTube in the House resolution. So I'm seeing this kind of big disconnect between your reliance on the House resolution and what actually...
Like, I talk about the YouTube and, right. You know, it's like, lady, you don't understand what's going on. I'm sorry. Come on, man.
Right. Like, it's just absolutely ridiculous how they're like, well, it didn't actually say, you know, Red Pill 78 or Craig's or Sarah's or Jason's thing. So, it, you know, let's give them a free pass and give them the full benefit of the doubt.
Hey, sure. Can I give you something that's also kind of interesting? They're missing something, a big one, right? The FBI doesn't legislate. They're not legislators, right? Yeah. So why are FBI acting as legislators deciding what can't be said? Only legislation can do that, right? So realistically, you know, I have to, you know, I say things the way I think, you know, sometimes I disagree, you know, with some of the things that other people do. I think that they're right in part, and wrong in another part. Part of this is that if they're taking away your life, liberty, or property, right, you're entitled to due process. Here, right. The United States is taking your property, your your liberty through a third party agent. That's really what's happening. And Section 230 is what's allowing that to happen. Okay. So if they're taking that, you're entitled to seek redress and you can't seek redress. So if you go after Google, the government's essentially standing in your way. Well, that's actually protected by the Constitution, because if the government is protecting that action to seek redress, they're violating your due process rights, right? So that now we've jumped to the Fifth Amendment from the First, right? But at the same time, if the government is doing what it's doing, right, the FBI is essentially legislating, it's making, you know, suggestions as to what to take down, and then Google's acting upon that, the government's to blame too. And that's why they're able to sort of point at each other and say, well, yeah, part of that's their fault and part of that's their fault. But the big thing here is that what they're not getting is that the government, if the government's involved in that action, the government has to be set aside and you need to be able to move forward, because the facts have to be, you know, in the most favorable light of the plaintiff. So if you're alleging that Google did something unlawfully, like, you know, you had spoken earlier about tortious interference. That's what our claim was. Mine had nothing to do with politics, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody that's on here is like, oh, well, they're just right wing red pill, you know, guys. It's no, mine's just money. They took it for money.
That's
and
right.
And what we said is like, hey, look, they took it. The government stopped me from being able to seek redress against them because they're a private corporation acting against me unlawfully, and the government insulated their ability to take my property. In other words, that's an illegal taking from the government. So the government is to blame as well. And that's sort of the position we're in right now, which is we sued Facebook. We took them all the way to the end. We lost. The government did its job. It protected everything that they did. And because of that, we now have the Article 3 standing to go after the government. You may be there. I mean, that's why you need the source, you know, the funding source, because this may be a lot longer than you think. Like I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to win this a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. They will throw everything in your path as much as it can. So, the, you know, it takes a lot of help. You know, if people want us to get this done, you know, you need to help them. I'm sure you understand that, Zach. I mean, this is an expensive war, and they know that.
Defendgo.com/defendfreespeech, and you can make your donation. And I have to address one of your commenters, Zach, real quick.
Okay.
DeepRail8 says, I'm old and I have a YouTube account. Just saying, not all old people are tech literate.
Of course.
To everybody who is here who took that the wrong way, and I think you're right, and I retract that comment, and I will say sorry for that. So I love you all. Well, I'm very sorry.
Yeah, everybody knows these statements are not blanket, but I mean, it's, you know, we got to throw in a little bit of humor and levity occasionally, because it's a heavy subject. I mean, this is pretty much everything riding on it at this point. And yes, and to your point, Jason, yeah, I mean, there was a time, you know, a couple of years ago where I thought, wow, we have such a good argument. This is going to work. You know, we're going to take it all the way to the bank and we're going to get our channels back and everything's going to be fine. And the longer it goes on, the less likely it appears. And the more that I allow myself to kind of just take a step back and remind myself that really this is in God's hands at this point. You know, if we are meant to win, then we will. But this is like an existential argument. Like, free speech is absolute, and we cannot allow this to stand. Craig, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was pointing to my God's grace is greater.
There you go. So, yeah.
I was going to focus on that. Yeah.
I was going to say, I almost feel better about it now. And I think Chris does too, as we go farther along, because hindsight is 20/20. And we have more details, and we have the evidence now to show, and the people are waking up. Everybody, the judge saying that it's national news, that the government's involved, mm-hmm. those kinds of things are important. Sure. That wasn't the consciousness back when we first did it. And they were still on to Section 230. Even the liberal judge, when she says, oh, what's a remedy? She pretty much agreed that this is a problem.
Yeah.
That's not where they were at back then. So the whole consciousness has shifted. So I think we're in a better spot. I mean, it's still going to be expensive. It's still going to be grueling, but I think it's a lot better. And I'm also more worried about the younger people, not because the old people can't have YouTube channels, because my parents do and everything else, but we're different. We didn't grow up with just the internet. And so we still can look at
things on paper, you know, the newspaper, or we'll go to a news site. The kids have a whole nother, I have kids that are in their young 20s, and they have a whole nother world that they're in. Their online world is different, and they grew up different. And so what's being fed to them this whole online narrative.
That's what I was speaking
to. It's their confusion.
You can't get it in a 3-minute TikTok video. It didn't happen. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't want anybody to think that I'm black-pilled. I have just gotten to the point where I have no expectations. Although, you know, I may have positive or negative feelings. I just allow myself to exist, essentially.
Yeah, answer my question. Where in the resolution?
In the resolution, the House specifically identified, I have to put glasses on for this, conspiracy theories. In the very first line, in the second, on ER-131,
right,
identified conspiracy theories in QAnon. In other words, it identified the specific speech that was the subject of this resolution, period. Okay. Then they use words about this kind of speech. Urge, condemn, encourage, and so forth. Words that are much stronger than the Supreme Court used in Blum. Then you look at the plaintiff's complaint, and they allege that they are the word the publishers of conspiracy theories, including conspiracy theories and QAnon. And you have then the immediately deplatforming of their content. So you have a direct link between the content that's identified in H.R. 1154 at ER 131, and the allegations made in plaintiff's complaint at paragraph 8. And so that's where you see the link. And the interesting thing is, the district court sort of mentioned the same thing, that there weren't enough facts about the plaintiff's content, and identified that that was a lacking of the complaint, that there should have been more detail.
I'm just assuming that all the QAnon and the disputes over it, let's just assume they were alleged. I don't see how it changes anything.
Well, I guess that is for this court to decide. If the court's going to decide that government overreaching and interference into private conduct, where there's a clear reaction that the private company, essentially, as we allege, has done the government's bidding to censor stuff that the government can do directly, but they're using YouTube to do for them. I mean, if the government says that there's going to have to be a command or a regulation, I mean, then we're creating new precedent for sure, because that's not what Blum versus Uretsky said. That's not what Bantam said. That's not what any of the cases have said, that there has to be a command. There is no such command, and the district court absolutely got it wrong when you look at the.
Yeah. So, and it looks like that got cut off a little bit, but, again, Google is using the government as sort of their shield. You can't sue us. Go after this other entity.
Can I ask the question? This is something I truly think after watching this again and again. Do these judges, has the propaganda worked so well that they think like we're QAnon? Is that like where this is? Because it's like, it feels like they're like, you know, even if they are QAnon, yeah, so you gotta get rid of that QAnon. I've heard he's a bad dude. And you're like, wait, what? And so it's like, I don't know how this is working the way it is, where they're like, oh yeah, you know, we gotta get rid of it. It's like, I think they may think that we are QAnon, and that's terrible.
Craig, let me inject something there. I don't think it has anything to do with that, because the reality is it's every case. My case has nothing to do with politics, and yet they do the same thing to me. They've done it to every single, like, anybody that comes through that court. They get these ridiculous answers that are just wrong. I mean, some of them are wrong. So, although you may be the crazy conspiracy theorist, you know, like I am too every now and again, but, you know, hey, sometimes you got to be right in the world. And of course, a lot of that stuff comes true. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it entirely relies on that. I wouldn't place it on that necessarily.
I was being sort of facetious, but yeah. Because at the same time, you have to ask yourself, like, you know, how are we at where we are? You know, I tell my audience it's easier to just think of me call me a conspiracy theorist, because then it's like, then I don't have to worry about anything after that. And you can take it with a grain of salt and believe it if you want. But, you know, you watch these judges go back and forth, and you just get really, really worried about the future of our country when they're the ones making decisions. And I think that they are just overwhelmed by the way technology has surpassed the courts, you know, to a degree, and their capability to legislate or to judicially decide you know, court cases, like we've said, you know, everything's hidden in the algorithm. Everything's hidden in discovery that we can't even get to in the first place. So that's kind of the danger of all this, where we've landed. But that's just my opinion.
And remember what Google said, like they testified, we don't apply any ideological filter on the channels that we have. Like they, you know, affirmatively, you know, stated that they don't, you know, judge any of this sort of content for its political basis. But that's exactly what they did, you know, in this case.
Yeah.
They lied.
It's fraud. And, it's fraud.
When they changed their slogan from don't be evil, I was a little worried.
Yeah, that's why we brought the fraud aspect, is because Facebook told everybody we're a platform for all ideas, of course, unless they don't agree with your ideas, and then you're gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just fraud. It's a lie.
It was like quite they changed the slogan from don't be evil to don't get caught. I think that's really when I started like, oh, you got a little problem here.
Oh, you guys, we're going to have to be wrapping it up here in just a few minutes. We're going on 5 hours. Well, I am going on 5 hours of being on the air, and I'm starting to fail just a little bit. My brain is starting to twitch. My mouth is getting really dry. But I need to say thank you to Fred Awakening over on Rumble. He says, I would like to advertise on your site, Zach. I'm releasing a new line of sleep aids featuring melatonin-infused almonds, cashews, and pistachios. They're called Doze Nuts. Also, it's an asshole. You had me until I got to the name, but thank you very much for the support. I appreciate it.
I'm stealing that idea if that's
not a good one. It's a good one. Let me see if we've got any questions over on the Foxhole. Lori Liberty, thank you for that. Can Navy Vet, he says, I love you, bro. I'm feeling much better. I'm Texas bound next week. Patriot Birds and guests are muted. That was from the beginning of the show. J2 Dank, thank you for the cookie. Just Josie, going forward, I will describe you with cookies. Tenacious. Low Country Brooklyn says, don't forget to help us with our Google YouTube suit. Give, send, go / defending free speech. Make sure that ING. Slug Trail, thank you for the cookie. Liberty Bells says, thank you, Red Pill, for your hard work, and I love you. Kaboomer, thank you for the cookie. Okay, so no specific questions. All right, guys. So, you know, Sarah, I like your attitude. I think you're right. This is probably going to go beyond the current court that we're in right now. I don't doubt that. I think that our chances once we get to the Supreme Court are probably going to be much better, especially considering the existing precedent that was already created in the Supreme Court. I think that they're probably the only ones that can, you know, truthfully understand exactly what we're facing here and the type of threats that were made. You know, at some point, the government can't continue to just blame YouTube, and the YouTube just can't continue to blame the government. I mean, there is a nexus there, and this is going to have to be resolved at some point. So I hope that it comes soon, but you know, I'll take it as it does.
We're going to keep on fighting until it does. Like, this is a long-term fight. We've been at this
absolutely
for 2 years now, right? Like, it's October. It's literally been 2 years. And, you know, I set out on
like,
this case.
Like, 2 years? You guys are rookies.
I'm probably going to at least be a decade into this thing by the time I'm done.
Oh. Mm-hmm. It's like where James Franco's at the gallows. It's like, your first time? You're like, yeah.
But it is a very long fight, though. And Zach, just be prepared, man. This is going to be...
Yeah,
but I'm there for you. Anytime you need me, you know, I'll give, you know, I want to see you guys succeed. I want to see somebody succeed.
Sure.
I mean, somebody's got to knock these guys down, because we all know this is ridiculous. The government gives them the power to take our speech away and then says, oh, it's not our fault, it's their fault. And they say, oh, it's not our fault, it's their fault. I'm just tired of it.
And since we have you on, Jason, thank you, Zach, for hosting this whole thing. But I just want to say one thing, that I saw you 2 years ago, I think, at American Priority Conference, when I heard about your story, and it was right when all this was happening to us, and it was your story that gave me hope that we could do this. So thank you for that. And I'm praying for you as well, that you're going to win, because we all got to stick together on it. So thank you, Jason, for that. Cause I remember listening to your story, amen, and thinking, man, it was so powerful. It moved me. I never forgot it from the time I sat in on that talk and heard you say it.
Yeah. The biggest thing is, guys, don't give up. Like, and your audience, help them out. This is insanely hard, you know, and we don't get any help. I mean, because, you know, just a quick little story real quick. I stood on the Capitol steps and announced, you know, our constitutional challenge with a congressman, and none of the media reported it. We don't get attention. We don't get help. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't happen. Why? Because we're doing the job. These are the guys, like all these guys here, man, I got to commend you. It's a hard fight. Stay in it. Keep going.
And we're personally invested in this. Sarah, You've put a tremendous amount of resources into this, not just time into creating this Give San Go and the constant fundraising that you're doing, but you also put a huge amount of your own money into this case. And so I think we should just give Sarah like a round of applause, you know, for what she's done to take this torch and pass it on to the next thing. So Sarah, like, you know, the Constitution, not just every single American, the Constitution itself owes you a debt of gratitude for what you've done to fight for all of our rights for free speech. And, you know, we're going to back you up and we're going to make sure that you can continue the fight. So thank you so much, Sarah, for all the hard work that you've done to keep this case going.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Jen. Yeah, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just appreciate everybody's in on this together because, you know, I'm fighting for my kids and for them and the next generation, because what are we going to leave them?
Yep.
You know what? This is not acceptable. We can't leave them this. And this is our it's our stewardship right now. And we can't leave it to them. Right.
Yeah. That's the only reason I do it.
It's our watch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Zach, for having us on.
Thank you for having me on, Zach.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I appreciate all of you. Thank you very much for your individual efforts and for the collective fight that we continue to engage in. If you would just everybody tell the audience where they can find you. Let's start with Craig up there.
Oh, yeah. Please come find me. If you like Zach's content, I'm sure you'll love mine. It's on Rumble at Just Informed Talk. I put a link in the chat for everybody on Rumble. I'm on Foxhole at the same channel. I'm on BitChute at the same channel. So wherever you want to find me, that's cool. Just come by, check out a show, and maybe one day I'll have Zach on my show. I've talked to him about it, and I'd love to have him as a guest. So maybe okay. We've had Zach Voorhees on several times. He's always a great guest, and Jason, maybe we'll get you on one day, and you know, and Sarah, you're great too. So hopefully we'll get everybody on, but. Thank you for doing that. Just check me out. Just Form Talk, Rumble. That's all I got. Thank you, though. Thank you for having me on, Zach. Appreciate it.
Anytime, brother. We'll stay in touch and we'll make it happen. Sarah, if you would, please, one more time.
Yes, sarahwestall.com. And then I'm on BitChute and Rumble and all over the place, just under my name. So sarahwestall.com. And then you can, I have a news site there going too. So I write articles as well. And, it's helping to get a lot more traffic to what I do. But, after all this, I feel a passion to get into more hardcore journalism that is so lacking. It's so incredible. It's not hard to be kind of good at journalism right now.
No, it's a pretty low bar.
Doing it.
Exactly. One lemon's the bar. We're doing great. We're doing great.
Yeah, Pulitzers all around should be, anyways. All right. And Jason, you as well, sir.
I would say socialmediafreedom.org is our site, Social Media Freedom Foundation. I probably actually invite you all down. We're planning an event in February around internet equality. We're partnering up with ALX Events, and we're looking to put on. It's either going to be – we haven't set a date yet, but we're either thinking February or May. But, you know, if people want to understand Section 230 a little bit better, if you go to socialmediafreedom.org, we've got a lot of stuff that we've written in there because we've been at this for a long time. You know, it kind of gives you a different perspective. I just recently had an article, an op-ed article published in Human Events that finally explains the platform versus publisher issue and mm-hmm. why it's so confusing. And I kind of put it in a way that most people can understand it. But yeah, socialmediafreedom.org. Thanks again, Zach, for having me on. I know we're running concurrent things, but man, I'm right behind you. Anytime you need my help, you know, Sarah, Craig, you know, Red Pill, anything you need, man. Like, I just want to see this done. That's all mm-hmm. I care about.
Appreciate it. Exactly. Yeah. Exact same boat. Exact same boat. I just want to see somebody win. It's time that we gave Google a black eye per the punch Google that we used to be known as. Okay. And of course, Zach Voorhees, finally, tell everybody where they can find you. Perpetual Maniac.
Twitter.com/perpetualmaniac. It was my gamer tag, became my everything tag. If you want to know how Google censorship works and their AI tool called Machine Learning Fairness, then please come to my website, zachvoorhees.com, where you can see how the sausage is made. If you're looking for the best place for news on the internet 24/7, where you can see all the guests here and more, then check out blast.video. It's not .com. It's not .net. It's blast.video. It scans YouTube, BitChute, Rumble, Brighteon, Gab TV for the influencers that you're watching every day anyways, combines it into one single website. It's the best place for news on the internet 24/7. And if it's not, then I'm going to find the place that's better. And I'm going to scrape their content, because that's essentially what I am. I've also got one last thing. We've got a social media network coming out. I'm working on called Walk Away with Brandon Straka. I came on the project. We're getting it launched. It's going to be absolutely amazing. And check it out when it launches in about a month or so after the midterms.
Okay, excellent. Looking forward to it. Two final thank yous over on Odyssey. TZ Burton says, just a small appreciation for all you do. I really appreciate that. And then over on Buy Me a Coffee, Tilly said, Zach, sorry it's been a while. Keep up the great work. I always look forward to your videos. Thank you. And please buy Muffin and Chi-Chi some treats. I certainly will. They'll appreciate it. I passed out the gold pills over on Foxhole. Thank you to everybody hanging out with us on all the various platforms. As soon as this stream is over, I'm going to isolate this portion of the show, and I'm going to put it out on a separate video. So if you want to share it, if you want to tell people about our efforts, if you want to help us support this lawsuit, then please consider sharing this on all of your social media platforms. And thank you very much to all of you for being here. I really appreciate it. To you at home, good luck and God bless. I will see you on Monday.